Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 31st, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the first measurement of alphane waves in the sun's corona, finding that microRNAs act as a regulator in the brain, and cancer survival rates. Why aren't they improving for adolescents? All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
While the interior of the sun reaches 15 million degrees, the surface measures only 5,000 degrees. Way out beyond the surface, in the corona, which extends more than a million kilometers from the surface, you might think it'd be cooler still, but it's actually a lot hotter, a million degrees or more.
In the solar corona, we don't understand why it's hot. That's a big mystery.
Stephen Tomchek is trying to solve that mystery. In a paper in this week's Science, Tomchek and colleagues report that they have observed alphane waves. It's the first time these waves have been measured in the corona, a possible explanation for why the corona is so hot. I spoke to Tomchek from his office at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado.
Well, we were looking at waves that were propagating in the solar atmosphere up into the corona, and these are alphane waves, waves where magnetic tension is the restoring force, and they can transmit energy up into the solar corona where it may be dissipated and may account for heating the corona to these million-degree temperatures.
Now, has anyone confirmed the existence of these waves before?
No, I think this is the first time they've been observed in the corona. They've been seen in the solar wind very, very far out by satellites sensing waves in situ out in the solar wind. So very, very far out from the sun they've been seen, but never before in the solar corona. So we're going to have to await confirmation by some other people. It looks like people are now seeing the waves further down in the atmosphere, maybe in the chromosphere. But I think in the corona, we're going to have to await some confirmation of this.
So to measure these, or did you have to develop some sort of new instrument?
Yeah, we developed a new instrument to look for these. The instrument wasn't only designed to look for alphane waves. It was also designed to look at the polarization of light emitted by the solar corona in order to infer something about the solar magnetic fields there, remote sensing of solar magnetic fields, if you will. But this instrument also turned out to be a very good instrument with which to look at waves in the corona.
What are some of the measurements that you got? Can you describe them for me?
Well, the alphane waves are kind of elusive because they're incompressible waves, so they're not changing the intensity of the corona. A lot of instruments look at the brightness of the corona, and if the brightness is fluctuating periodically, it would be seen. But these alphane waves are not causing periodic intensity fluctuations, but they are moving the plasma back and forth. So in order to see them, one has to look at the Doppler motion, the velocity of the plasma that is oscillating, rather than the intensity, which is a little more difficult to do. Most instruments aren't able to look at that velocity. And one also needs to look at the velocity fairly quickly, because the periods of the waves are about 5 minutes. So you need to make measurements much faster than 5 minutes in order to see these waves. And you need to look over a very large field of view, because these waves are moving very fast and they're covering a lot of ground in the corona. So you need to basically image the corona over a large field of view with velocity signal and do it quickly.
Is there enough energy in these waves to answer why the corona is so hot compared with the surface of the sun?
We don't see enough energy in these waves to heat the corona, but we're not seeing a very fine detail. Our resolution is about 9 arc seconds. Our little pixels on the sun are 4.5 arc seconds across. So it may be that we are attenuating the signal because we're averaging over a lot of waves within our resolution element. So the waves that we resolve do not have enough energy to heat the corona, but it may be that there are a lot of waves beneath our resolution, which in total are capable of heating the corona.
So what's next then along this research path? Is it to develop something with higher resolution or send a kind of instrument out into space to get these measurements, or what?
Those would be good things. From the ground, we are trying to develop a larger coronagraph, which would have more spatial resolution. So that would be one avenue to pursue. it could be possible to also put an instrument into space, but we don't have any plans for that as of yet.
Okay. Well, is there something that you're going to be able to get from having made these measurements and you know, they offer the possibility of probing the plasma environment of the solar corona?
Mm-hmm. Well, the speed at which these alpha waves propagate depends on the strength of the magnetic field lines that they're propagating along. So an important thing, it's very difficult to measure magnetic fields, the strength of magnetic fields in the solar corona. It's very difficult to do. So any information that one can get about coronal magnetic fields is important. So the speed of propagation of these alpha waves depends on the strength of the magnetic field line that they're propagating along. So if one can measure that speed, the alpha speed, one can infer the magnetic field strength. And that would be a very valuable thing to be able to do.
It sounds like then that will help out with getting at lots of the mysteries of the sun.
Hopefully, yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks again for your time.
Okay. Thank you.
Stephen Tomczyk is lead author of a paper reporting the first observation of Alphane waves in the solar corona. Read more in the August 31st issue of Science. Also this week in Science, a new molecule-sized electronic switch. While material scientists have been developing molecule-sized switches for some time now, this new switch does not require drastic shape changes, so it might be used to assemble more complicated molecular-sized devices, building block style. Read the paper by Peter Liljeroth and colleagues in this week's Science. What do little bits of ribonucleic acid, or microRNAs, have to do with Parkinson's disease, a degenerative disorder of the central nervous system that impairs motor skills and speech? In a paper in this week's Science, researchers report that microRNAs act as regulators of midbrain dopamine neurons, cells that are lost in patients with Parkinson's. I spoke about it with the paper's senior author, Asa Abeliovich, from his office at Columbia University in New York.
In this study, the primary objective is not really to study what goes wrong in Parkinson's disease, but we did nonetheless take as our starting point patients with Parkinson's disease, and we looked for changes in these patients to try to understand how the cells that are lost in Parkinson's disease, how these dopamine neurons are regulated. So prior studies have identified certain types of molecules that regulate the development and function of dopamine neurons, but we looked at a different kind of molecule, a different kind of regulator that recently has been found to play important roles in the development of simpler organisms like flies and worms, and which has been known to be present in the brain, but exactly what these molecules, what these novel regulators do had been less clear.
What are these novel regulators? What are they called? What are they genetically?
Yeah, so these are microRNAs. They're short RNA molecules. And so RNA molecules have usually been thought of as a go-between between our genetic material, DNA, and the sort of workhorse of the cell, which is the proteins, which are, for instance, enzymes and make things. So that's how traditionally RNA is thought of. But more recently, it's been found that a number of very short RNA molecules play a completely different role. And what they do is regulate the expression of yet other genes. So they're regulatory molecules, but they're a very novel type of regulatory molecules that's really different from the way most people had thought of RNA.
What do they do that's different? What's novel about them?
Yeah, so instead of encoding proteins, these very short RNA molecules regulate the expression of proteins. So they turn off the expression of specific proteins. And what we found is that when these regulatory molecules are completely absent, then the dopamine neurons do very poorly and die, and consequently rodents that lack these sorts of regulatory molecules eventually become very Parkinsonian. They look and behave similar to patients with Parkinson's disease. So microRNA clearly plays an important role in the survival of dopamine neurons. We're not saying that that's actually the mechanism by which the cells die in Parkinson's disease, but we think that this is an important regulatory mechanism in the survival of the cells.
Anything else?
The other important role that we found for these regulatory molecules is actually in the function of these cells. So even when the cells are still present in patients with Parkinson's disease or in normal individuals, even when these cells are present, they have to be carefully regulated. That involves both signals that come from outside and signals within the cells. And it turns out that these short regulatory RNAs, these microRNAs, are important in regulating the function of dopamine neurons. And that's important to us because we want to be able to ultimately develop drugs that alter the function of dopamine neurons. And if we can gain a clear understanding of how they're regulated, then we're a step forward in trying to develop such drugs.
So what's next along the path here?
At this point, we need to really have a more complete understanding of the microRNAs that play a role in these dopamine neurons. We know that as a whole, they're important in the survival of the dopamine neurons. And we know we've identified at least one such microRNA that plays an important role in regulating the dopamine neurons. But we know that there are other microRNAs that are important in the dopamine neurons, and we still need to understand what they're doing there and how they play a role.
In other words, so the complex web of the neurotransmitters requires a complex web of microRNAs to help regulate them?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I'd say once we have a more complete understanding, then that'll really help us because I think ultimately these will potentially turn out to be valuable drug targets. So we can try to develop drugs that change the function of this pathway. And I think that'll really help us potentially ultimately develop drugs. But we're far away from that.
Well, how many of these additional microRNAs are there to study their pathways?
We really don't even know the answer to that. People have had very broadly ranging numbers from a few hundred to many thousands. So we don't have a clear idea of exactly how many microRNAs are important in these cells.
Well, it sounds like a challenging path ahead.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Asa Abiliovich and colleagues write about microRNA and its role in midbrain dopamine receptors. Read the paper along with a related perspective in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, urban planning, about 5,000 years ago. Researchers analyzed evidence from Tell Brak, an archaeological site in northeastern Syria, and found that instead of the city growing out from a central place, people who lived in this ancient Mesopotamian city lived first in small settlements. The settlements eventually grew together and the population became denser towards the center, suggesting that there wasn't a strong central authority and going against the typical model of Mesopotamian development. Read the perspective by Jason Ure and colleagues, as well as a related news story in the August 31st Science. Since the 1970s, scientists have been collecting data on the survival rates of cancer patients. While it may be of little or no comfort to anyone with cancer, survival rates generally have been going up for children and adults. However, the survival rates of adolescents and young adults have remained the same for decades, and scientists are trying to understand why. Science News writer Jennifer Cousin writes about it in this week's Science.
There's more and more agreement among doctors and cancer researchers that older teenagers and young adults, the 15 to 40-year-olds, really have not been improving their survival from cancer over the last few decades, whereas younger kids and older adults have been showing, you know, slow but steady improvement in cancer survival.
Where is this data coming from that this is happening?
It's coming from a few different places. It's been collected and presented by advocates for this age group. One of them is a doctor named Archie Blyer, who's a pediatric oncologist who now lives out in Oregon. There's also the Lance Armstrong Foundation, which has increasingly been advocating for more attention to this group, which isn't all that surprising since they were founded by a young adult cancer survivor, Lance Armstrong, the famous cyclist who survived testicular cancer that had spread.
Is there any growing consensus about why that's happening with adolescents and young adults, that the survival rates are stagnant?
Well, I think there are lots of possible reasons that people are considering, and there's probably more than one thing going into this. One important issue is that this age group is really poorly represented in clinical trials, and those trials go on to develop new treatments. So treatments just are not being developed specifically for this age group. And there are a whole lot of other factors. They're often diagnosed a little later because they may not have health insurance, or the doctors may not expect them to have cancer, and probably other issues in this age group too. But the clinical trials is a big one. And there are also some questions about whether the biology of some cancers in this age group is just different and maybe more aggressive.
So what's needed to boost survival here then? Is it more clinical trials that are focused on them, or what?
I think probably a lot of different things. Certainly, there's an interest in getting more clinical trials geared to this age group. There's a leukemia trial that's hopefully going to be starting up in the fall that will be trying to improve survival in 16 to 29-year-olds. People are also starting to look at the biology of the disease, collecting tissue samples from older teens and young adults, and try and understand if the cancer that they get is different, if it shows up in different parts of the body, and what may be going on here that can be better targeted with new drugs.
Is the cancer itself different among young adults and adolescents, or is it something else?
It's possible that the cancer itself is different. For example, there's a form of leukemia that is the most common cancer in younger kids, and it's now a lot more curable than it used to be. But that same leukemia, even in older teenagers, people just a few years older, tends to be much more difficult to treat. And it's not clear why. They might be getting the wrong treatment. The cancer itself might be more aggressive. People don't really understand it, but they do think something in that case might be going on with the biology. In other cancers, there could be other issues that aren't about the biology.
What about gender differences, maybe in the biology of these cancers?
People are starting to look at that. I think the issue there might be that it's not so much in the tumor, but that the biology of the patient might be somehow changing the cancer or the response to drugs. So one cancer where that is being looked at is by a physician in Australia named David Thomas, who's looking at this in a cancer called Ewing sarcoma, which affects bone and soft tissue. And he has found that while girls and boys, younger kids, seem to respond just the same to treatment in young women and young men, there's quite a difference. And girls have higher survival rates than boys in Ewing sarcoma, but also in some other cancers like bone cancer and a type of leukemia.
Do researchers have any idea why that girls are having greater survivability rates than boys?
I think right now it's really just speculation why there's a difference between the young men and the young women here. One thing that people know is that in puberty, once someone goes through puberty, women have a much higher percentage of fat in their body than men do, whereas with girls and boys, it's about the same before puberty. So it's possible that this extra fat is somehow affecting the distribution of chemotherapy drugs and how much is actually getting to the tumor. That's just one theory, and there are some others out there too.
So back to these survival rates among adolescents and young adults, what are researchers doing with this knowledge that those rates have stagnated?
Well, they're trying to do a number of different things. They're really trying to get a better handle on, you know, whether some of these tumors are actually different biologically in this age group so that they can design better treatments to target them. They want to enroll more older teenagers and young adults in clinical trials. They also just want to generally raise awareness about cancer in this age group, make sure that people are getting the best treatment they can, because right now it's not clear that they always do. It's possible that a young adult who might get a more pediatric cancer is being given a more quote-unquote adult treatment, where the combination of drugs are different, the therapy might be a bit less intensive because older people are not able to tolerate chemotherapy as well as younger kids. So maybe they should start giving young adults and even potentially somewhat older adults a more pediatric therapy. That's something that people are starting to look at.
Suppose you're a cancer patient and you're listening to this. What should they take away from your article?
Well, I think that it's important to find physicians who specialize in that cancer, because I think one problem that people mention to me is that young adults, by virtue of their age, end up in adult facilities, but those facilities may not have the same expertise as a children's hospital at treating their cancer. And the opposite could be true too. It just depends on the kind of cancer. So that would probably be a big thing, to make sure that the doctors who treat them really know this cancer and really treat this age group and are doing what they can to really help people get better. One other thing that people mentioned to me is that it really makes a difference to connect with other young adults who've had cancer or who currently have cancer. And a lot of the advocates who are working in this area who have survived cancer found it really helpful themselves to connect with others going through the same thing. And that's something that more and more young adults with cancer are trying to do by forming advocacy groups and reaching out to other people.
Sounds like that's advice for anybody going through cancer, but particularly young people?
Yes, I think what I was told is that young people tend to be more isolated. There are fewer of them, and their diseases might be a little rarer, and then they're divided between two different types of hospitals. So it can be harder to meet people, and they might be in a waiting room filled with 60-year-olds, or they might be in a waiting room filled with 5-year-olds, and it can make a big difference to really connect with other people who are at the same stage of life.
Well, thanks so much for sharing this story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Science News writer Jennifer Cousin writes about stagnant survival rates of adolescent and young adult cancer patients. Read more about it in the August 31st issue of Science. Finally today, Eric Stockstead, managing editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is in the studio with Science Magazine's online editor, Stuart Wills, for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
Well, Eric, welcome to the studio. What have you got for us today?
Hi, Stuart. Let's talk about three stories that we ran on Science Now recently. One is about baby talk in rhesus monkeys. We'll also talk a little bit about the big nothing out there in outer space, and end up with a fun story about the genetics of wine.
So a lot of something and a lot of nothing. Well, let's start with a little baby talk.
Yeah, baby talk is something that was thought to be just for babies, for human babies. And there was some interesting observations with rhesus monkeys that suggested that they might do something similar. Most researchers thought that these grunts and high-pitched nasal noises that the monkeys were doing...
And these are the mother monkeys
talking? These are the mother monkeys talking when infants are around. Most scientists thought the mothers were talking to each other. But a new study that was done on an island in Puerto Rico suggests that the mothers may be talking to their infants. So what they did was observe 19 monkeys for about 2 years, and they noticed that after the birth season, after the mothers gave birth, the number of grunt calls and nasal calls increased tremendously. And it seemed like the mothers were keeping an eye on the infants, and when infants wandered off, they would make this call and make eye contact to the young monkeys. So that suggests that it might be an equivalent of baby talk, talk directed to a baby.
Well, I think that's a little bit suspect, isn't it? I mean, how can they assume that it's actually being directed at these babies?
It is a tough thing to do, especially when you have a big gaggle of monkeys, to be really sure. On the other side, the vocalizations, the quality of them, there's something soothing about them. So it seems like it calms the mothers and the infants, which, you know, is another aspect which makes it like human baby talk.
Okay, so let's jump from a rhesus colony in Puerto Rico to the depths of the universe, and I guess a giant zone that's completely empty out there.
Well, not completely empty, but pretty much mostly empty. So it might seem like outer space is empty. I mean, we call it outer space and not outer stuff. But there's lots of gas and dust in between galaxies, and there's elusive dark matter as well. But not everywhere, it seems. Researchers who were using the Very Large Array Sky Survey, which is mapping the whole universe, came across an enormous patch where there doesn't seem to be anything. Doesn't seem to be any visible matter, doesn't seem to be any dark matter.
And how big is this thing?
Seems to be about 1 billion light years across.
Wow.
which is big. The only thing that they could detect was a kind of radiation called the cosmic microwave background, which is left over from the Big Bang.
Okay, but what about dark matter? I mean, we hear all about dark matter in the universe. Isn't it possible there's just dark matter in here that we haven't seen yet?
Oh, some people are so skeptical. dark matter, it is. It's a tough measurement to make, so not everybody's convinced. But if they're right, it could have big implications, because a big void of nothing is not really predicted by what you'd expect as a result of the Big Bang. A leading model of the Big Bang called inflation suggests that you will have voids in the universe, but they'll be all about the same size, not a big whopper like this one.
Sounds like quite a mystery, and makes me want to come back to planet Earth, so let's go back and study a little wine now.
Yeah, wine is a complex beverage. It's full of all sorts of molecules that contribute to its taste and aroma, and that's why we can use sophisticated intellectual terms like flinty to describe it. So to get a more precise handle on things, several groups are trying to figure out what the genome is of the grapevine, of the various varietals that people turn into wine. This new study was done on Pinot Noir, and a big consortium of French and Italian, surprise, surprise, researchers, they created an inbred variety. So for technical reasons, they had to do this to make the sequencing feasible. When they got it, they were able to sequence 93% of the genome, and they found a lot of complexity in the genes that code for things like polyphenols, which are typically involved in the flavor and the aroma. A lot more families, well, the families are a lot larger of those genes than in non-grape plants.
So I guess it's what you'd expect, in a way, given the properties of wine, that these particular qualities of aroma and whatnot are things that have, for whatever reason, been selected for over time.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a surprise. The way it will be useful is really right now for directing further studies to learn about how ripening happens, how the composition of fruit matters, maybe even how the environment that grapes are planted in affects their quality.
Well, Eric, very interesting as always. Thanks for being with us.
Cheers, Stuart.
Eric Stockstedt is the managing editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of Science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the August 31st, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.